Good times.
Yeah, thank you. Have some box.
Yeah, don't. Kyle's like, whatever.
It was so funny. I don't know what's going on.
Kyle's just staring at it.
Carnage. I just want to see the carnage. Oh, man. Alex, if you don't mind praying for us this morning, that'd be awesome. So Tiana's husband's not doing real well. So Alex and them are chummy, good friends. So, yeah, he's going to pray for them and pray for our morning. So thanks, my friend.
Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for letting us be able to see our classmates and seeing Mike again. And we're thinking about Tiana, her not being here, Father, and we pray that you would encourage them, God, as a couple of them being one flesh. They both feel when one is not doing as well as the other. And we pray that they would be there to lean on each other and to lift each other up. And that we can do that from afar. Pray that she would know that we're thinking of her. And that you teach us, Lord, what it means to be your children and reflect you well on this earth. In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen. And my buddy had his dad found out yesterday, yeah, that his dad went in for like some chest pain, something or other, and all of a sudden they were like, you need a double bypass, like right now. You're going into surgery. So, yeah. And it's funny, just not funny, but like, man, life happens, right? And some of us are like, woo, life's great. And then in a moment, man, life can get weird, so, and tough and hard. So just be mindful, man. There's a lot happening, and there always is this time of year in the fall, and people are going. So, all right. Proverbs 23, let's start there this morning. This is a fun one to kind of walk through. For those of you guys that are going to end up in any type of philanthropic world, be it church, be it nonprofit, be it where anybody is donating to an organization or a movement that you're a part of, you will, without a doubt, deal with this. And if you are not prepared for it, you're going to wish you were. It's a great thing, but it can also be a really bad thing if you don't know and can't see kind of what's going on here. Proverbs 23, verses 1 through 3. Fascinating little proverb Solomon given to his kids. So when someone's there, if you don't mind, read it for us.
When you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you.
All right, so you're sitting down having dinner with a ruler. Who is a ruler? What do they have? That's a yardstick. Very good. Woo-hoo, Julie's had his coffee. He said, what's a ruler have? And he said, 12 inches. Maybe 36. Got it. It actually took me a second. What else may a different type of ruler have?
Authority,
power, means, wealth. Okay, keep going. Put a knife to your throat if you're a man of great appetite. What does that mean? Why not? Why is this about calorie counting? Is this about childhood obesity? Is this, what is this? Why not enjoy what's there in front of you? Why? Keep going to the part of three. What's the warning about? For his food is deceptive food. Do not desire his delicacies. What's the idea here? Why is this guy sitting you down and giving you a filet mignon and asparagus and a nice glass of vino? What's going on here, Jimmy?
He's trying to get you to buy into
it. Yeah, this isn't a free meal, is it? There's a what's called a hidden agenda. There are strings attached to that steak, if you will. And if you're a man of great appetite or a woman of great appetite and you desire these things that a rich man may have, that you may not have, then you're going to buy into that hook, line, and sinker. And whatever this man is about to offer come dessert time, this is why he brought you there to begin with. And if you're not careful, your heart can be pulled in that direction. There are lots of people out there, and I'll tell you stories about them here in a second, where there are no strings attached to things, that they're just giving and generous and love the Lord. But sometimes there are strings attached, and you have to know the difference. When we were in college at our church in town, we had a little facility out kind of in the east side of town, and this guy came to our high school pastor and basically offered him the land at the equivalent of Whitby in Fresno, the corner of 41 and Shaw. and said, it's yours. I would like to give it to you. 20 acres, however, I mean, like the best plot of land in town. And he said, I'd like to give that to the church to bless you. And the youth pastor was like, I just wet my pants. Goes to the senior pastor, talk to him. The senior pastor promptly wet his pants as well. Like, are you kidding me? They go out and look at it. They're like, holy cow, the building we could build, the ministry we could do, like the center of Denton, like this would be perfect. Well, they start doing some digging and they realize, well, the guy's not actually going to give them the land. He actually just wants them to take over his month-to-month payments on that, which they find out was the equivalent of basically adding 3 full-time staff members. And then they come to find out that the guy's in some financial trouble, and he's actually trying to offload the land because he can't float the note anymore, so he's just trying to move it along, all underneath the auspices of it's a gift, and I just really want to bless the work of Denton Bible Church. It was a string. It was a hidden agenda, right? A number of years ago here at the Well, we were at the, what was at the time, the Cross Church, meeting in the evening, setting up chairs, setting up tables every week, the same deal. That's kind of how we did church, renting a facility. The Cross Church was extremely generous to let us be there. But man, we were dying for a place like this where we could just have a facility that would we knew would increase our impact in the city. And some individual who I don't even know, to this day I don't know, comes to Brad and says, man, I would like to give you $1 million for the work of the Well Community Church. No strings attached. I don't even attend your church, but I hear the work you're doing. I hear the impact you're having on the next generation. And if you'll continue to do that, here's $1 million to buy this facility that happened to be for sale. And Brad started digging, like, who are you? Like, man, is this, show me the strings. And lo and behold, there were none. He just said, man, that's a gift. We've had a good year, and here you go. We bought that facility with the money that God raised through a guy that doesn't even attend our church that just said, here. And we had to raise money on top of that. I didn't pay for all of it, but it was literally a free gift. The guy was just generous. Working in a nonprofit. I've seen that all the time. It's insane. I was talking to a couple years ago about a school that we had the potential to be a part of and why we couldn't be a part of it. And I said, man, it's like a $30,000 a year commitment. And when we go into a school, it off the front, we commit to 3 years. So it's a $90,000 commitment. I'm like, that's a ton of cash. And we just can't jump into a new school. I get a phone call from this guy a few days later saying, hey, my wife and I talked about it. We ran into some extra money, and we'd like to commit to 3 years at that school. Can you get the rest of the work done? I said, yes, I think I can. And there's no strings, right? It was a gift to bless what we're doing. So as you guys think about that in the worlds that you're going to be in, you're going to see both sides, but you've got to be shrewd, and you've got to understand, hey, are there strings here? Are there expectations? Are you trying to buy my loyalty with a steak and a glass of wine? Because that's not going to happen. Now, if you want to bless the work of what God's doing through the gospel ministry of such and such place, and you want to be a part of that, man, amen, right? Put your check in the tithe box. Great. But there are no, you're not going to buy my loyalty. And there's a lot of people out there through time and through business and that have learned to use their power and whatever that expect that a check comes with some sort of benefits coming back to them, right? We see it all the time in the sports world with kids and, hey, I'm a big donor to such and such high school, so my kids should get more playing time than your kid. It's like, you know, it's out there. So as you guys encounter that, and as you think about the worlds that you're going to be in, be aware of that, okay? And if God so happens to bless you and you get to be Daddy Warbucks, good for you, okay? Bless people. Bless people unconditionally. Write big, fat checks to the work of the gospel ministry all over this city and beyond, and do it without strings. Find places where the Spirit of the Lord is moving and bless them greatly, okay? So if God has given you those abilities in business to raise funds, that's another side of the equation that we need as well. Some of you will be on both sides of that, all right? So enjoy it, whatever God may give you, okay? All right, thoughts on that before we move on? All right, Genesis, let's return there. So we finished the planks. You guys are a week away from... week and a day away from handing me an assignment on those, right? Getting ready to teach the planks. I don't see any panic yet. Okay, that's good. We all remember. Oh, no. We'll just verbally talk about it. So, yeah, sorry. Thank you for clarifying. So, good stuff, okay? Now, and you've got, I guess, the rest of the story yesterday with Rick, the rest of Genesis 11 and following. You got the whole kit and caboodle with Sumer and all that stuff. By the way, did Rick walk you through yesterday? Genesis 1, yeah, you guys get a good feel for that? Good. Okay, I'm glad you guys are seeing multiple good evangelical views of how this world could have started, okay? So, great. Good that you guys are getting all that, okay? So now we're in Genesis 12, right? We ventured into Abraham. We've seen this crazy call of God on this guy's life who's never heard this voice before. He leaves home, loses everything that's comfortable, and he goes into the land of Canaan, okay? And I want to do something for you guys this morning. Just every now and again, there's things I think that help us understand to a greater ability kind of what's going on through song and media and what have you. And I think this is one of those that was just really helpful to me. Just to kind of get a picture of the ludicrousness, is that a word? Ludicrousness? Yeah. Of really what God asked Abraham to do. Okay, this is a song by a guy by the name of Andrew Peterson. He is a PK's pastor's kid, writes music. It's an older song. What I love about him is he's an old Presbyterian kid. He's an old soul, and you're going to get from his music some stupid good theology in the midst of just some great storytelling. So I just want you guys to listen to this. The words will be up on the screen if you can't see them. But just take a listen and think about this in terms of Genesis 12 and the call on Abraham's life. Okay, this is working super. We're connected. This is why you test things out. It was before, yeah. I'm on the TV cart. I got that. Why do I have sound?
It was running. Yeah. It was good.
Sean was rolling it. I know, but there's still no tunes.
It's going.
It's going, but there's no music. There's actually music to this.
Maybe that's how the song starts.
Trust me, it isn't.
Boo.
How about? What do we got, dude? We got the cable back here. That one won't work. I need an HDMI. All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to borrow this.
Did you check your sound output settings?
Oh, that's probably what it is. You can plug straight in now.
There's music playing on the TV earlier.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Let's just try this and see if we get more better. Actually, I'm going to kill you. Go away. Disconnect. Sorry, guys. This computer and I really have this kind of love-hate relationship. By love-hate, I mean mostly hate, but kind of love.
Kind of love technology.
There we go.
What does TF mean?
That's the organization you serve in.
Oh, TF. Is this guy singing or rapping?
Yeah. Bro, I'm a white guy from Texas. You're not getting any rap out of me. Let me mean it.
Sarah, take me by my arm. Tomorrow we are Canaan bound. Where westward sails the golden sun. And hills are amber crowned. So bid your troubled heart be still. The grass, they say, is soft and green. The trees are tall and honey-filled. So Sarah, come and walk with me. Like the stars across the heavens flung, like water in the desert sprung, like the grains of sand are many suns. Oh, Sarah, fair and barren womb. trembled at the voice of God, a voice of love and thunder deep. With love he means to save us all, and love is chosen you.
Cool, huh? Yeah, it's a good song. Anyway, old school guy, but yeah, just I think, I so often forget that, man, this was 4,000 years ago, and Abraham was a real dude with a real wife, with real concerns, with real fears, laying in bed at 11 o'clock at night, you know, with his wife's hand, like, we're going to go do this, you know, and this is nuts. So, sorry. It reminds me of, he's a hero, and it's just the faith that is required to make a journey like that, right? It's insane. So just I want us to all be cognizant of that. These aren't just stories. These aren't just things that we, you know, to gloss over, if you will. So just to connect with him on that level and think through what it must have taken, the faith required, the obedience required, and for a guy that we're going to see is still very much in process, right? He's jacked in a lot of ways, but yet he had the courage and faith to go, all right, Lord, I'm not even sure who you are, but I'll go, okay? So with that, back into Genesis 12, let's pick up on his story and just remember where we've been. Okay, we saw some of the most important texts that I would argue in your Bible of the Abrahamic covenant, okay? And if I asked you guys that and you were to give me the three aspects of the Abrahamic covenant, you would say to me they are what? Land, seed, and blessing, okay? All promised to Abraham, unilateral covenants given by God that he said, I will do these things, and it's so important. We're going to see this reiterated several times over Abraham's life. This literally is everything in his life. He's clinging to this. His whole life's trajectory is now going to be aligned with this promise by God. And you're going to see ultimately this is what's important to Abraham. Okay, so we saw this journey into the land. As soon as he got in the land, what did we see happen? What happened?
Famine.
The famine, right? So what does Abraham do? He hightails it to Egypt, right? He mans up. Is probably most of us would do, at least that's the assumption, to be responsible, go to Egypt, feed my family. He goes there. He makes some pretty dumb decisions when he gets there with his wife. What does he do with that in Pharaoh? You're my sister, right? You're not my wife. I don't want to die here. They're going to take you. And sure enough, he was right. Wow, your sister wife is really beautiful. We're going to go ahead and take her. God steps in, saves the day at the rest of chapter 12. Abraham leaves. He leaves with abundant blessing, as we see. And then 13, he returns kind of back to where it all started. He goes back to the Oaks of Mamre, and he prays. He reconnects with God. We talked about the significance of that, of times in our lives when we blow it and just feel like we need to go bury our head in the sand and we're a failure. Abraham doesn't. He prays. He trusts God. God restores him. And he goes back to the altar that he'd originally built, the place he last had fellowship with God. And, man, he prays. And God is still there, still loves him, even in the midst of his own difficulties, as you and I kind of know the feeling of that story all too well in our own lives, but there is grace and there is grace abundant. So in chapter 13, verse 5 and following, now we're going to see what's going on with he and Lot. Who's Lot?
His nephew,
right? So Abraham's uncle, his kid, he died, right? Haran is his uncle. Terah's the grandfather, his dad. And now he's kind of taking Lot as his kind of adoptive son, nephew. Okay, so chapter 13, verse 5, let's pick up here. Okay, so what are we seeing with, what's God doing? What do you call that? Why couldn't they dwell together? There's abundance. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's great, right? God is blessing their socks off. So they're seeing abundance, so much so that their cattle ranch can't support all their cattle anymore. They've got to divide. They've got to move on. So God is giving them great abundance, which is awesome, but it's creating now issues. Verse 7, keep going.
And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock.
Okay, so what's that creating now? Strife. We don't want that, right? Now there's tension in the family. You can imagine, we're going to see this with Jacob, Abraham's grandson, and Laban later on, like cattle and issues and sheep and whose is what's, and there's just nasty tension. So you're getting the idea that Abraham's men and servants and Lot's men and servants and cattle and sheep and whatever they have they're at odds with one another. So this is not a good situation. So they got a decision to make. We see a note there, verse 7. Now the Canaanite, the Perizzite were dwelling in the land. The Canaanites are, again, the big group of people that are native to that land. The Perizzite are kind of a subfamily. So they're there with them. So they're having this family spat in the midst of the non-Christian that's around, and they're having to deal with this, okay? So watch how Abraham handles this. This is fascinating to me. Katie, keep reading if you don't mind. So Abraham initially says, listen, we don't want tension, okay? We don't. Like, this is not good. Keep rolling.
Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left.
What's Abraham do? Huh. Who has the right to choose first? Abraham. He's older. He's the uncle. But what does he do? He denies his rights and says, Lot, you choose. Man, you have first dibs. Anything you want. If you want left, I'll go right. You want right, I'll go left. What do you want to do? I don't want strife. This relationship is far more important to me than stuff. So you choose. There's plenty. God will bless, right? Now, remind you, this is just after Abraham has blown it, right, in Egypt. And he's come back. You can see kind of his response to God and just this idea of, man, God's restored him. He feels that. He doesn't feel like a failure. He's moving on, right? And he knows that God's on his side. So he gives Lot first dibs, right? And Lot's going to choose. So keep rolling in verse 11, and let's watch how Lot chooses.
You want to skip verse 10?
No, we should probably read that. Sorry. When I say 11, I mean 10. All right, so Lot, can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Is that really helpful? Should I make it smaller? How's that? Better? What about that?
A little more?
Okay. All right, so here is the area that they're in, okay? Is remember Shechem, okay? That's where they started. The Negev is right here. This is Beersheba. So he says to Lot, you choose. You choose what you want. And he talks about what cities do you see jump out at you? Sodom and Gomorrah, we know about those. Okay, those are coming. Chapter 19, we're going to get the full story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Historically, it's believed that Sodom and Gomorrah are actually here. Okay, you'll see there's a question mark on the map. Literally last year, as I was teaching residency, they made a discovery just north of the Dead Sea, Tel El Haman, in this area up here, and they believe that to be where Sodom and Gomorrah is. Okay. Don't know for sure, based on archaeological evidence and those sorts of things, they think that Sodom and Gomorrah is actually north of the Dead Sea. I know you guys have been waiting for that information for like years, but this is more than likely wrong, okay? So they're looking around, and Lot sees this. Now, when you go to Israel with me, I'm going to take you there, and you're going to wonder, why would Lot choose this? Well, back in Lot's day, 4,000 years ago, the geography of this land apparently looked a lot different. It says that it's well-watered, it's beautiful. Remember, Lot's a Bedouin, he's a herdsman, he's taking his sheep somewhere. This is dry. This is Mojave Desert, okay? rock, dust, sand, no green, none of you would go, you know what, absolutely, I'm going to go live in Needles. That sounds awesome. That's not the normative, right? But in that day and age, apparently it was. They're in the Negev, yeah. They went up to Mamre, so they're probably somewhere in between Bethel and Ai. So they started in Shechem. Mamre's probably somewhere around here. So they're in this area, again, feeding their sheep. Home base would have been in Beersheba, but they're up and down this area. So when they choose...
So they're like on a hilltop right now. He's up on where he can see in the valleys.
Correct. So I'll walk you guys through the geography of Israel later. There are four kind of distinct areas that run north and south. You got the coastal plains, just like in California. You've got low hills, think Fresno foothills. Then you've got the Judea Mountains, which are the highest portion of Israel that run here. So north and south, there's this big mountain chain here, which is where Jerusalem is. Jerusalem is, by the way, right there. So directly across from the tip of the Dead Sea, straight over west, is Jerusalem. Okay, it sits at 3,200, 3,300 feet in elevation. That's the highest point. And then you go straight down to the Rift Sea, or the Rift, down to the Rift Valley, to the Dead Sea, to the lowest point on Earth. Okay, so the Dead Sea literally is like 7 to 1,200 feet below sea level, lowest place on Earth. Okay, so they would have been able to overlook everything and see down. Now, from there in their day, without pollution and everything, you could easily see the Dead Sea. So he sees that. He sees this green, fertile land, and they're going to walk now 30-so-odd miles from Jerusalem. That trek would be about that long, and see that. So that's what he chooses, okay? So whatever reason, that's what Lot wants, and that's what Lot chose, okay? Verse 11, Katie, did we read that yet?
No.
Please.
So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east, as they separated from each other.
Okay, so how does Lot choose? East, okay? That's always a sign, right? You're seeing that, good. What else do you notice in verse 11? So Lot chose for himself. What do you see? It's absent in Lot's life.
He didn't think about Abram.
Doesn't think about Abram. He's thinking about himself. Do you see any consultation with Lord? Where do you want me to go? You don't see we don't see any faith in Lot at this point. We don't know. Lot's an interesting guy. Hebrews is going to paint him as a guy that's kind of a wayward believer, if you will. So apparently he has the faith that Abraham is kind of in the family passed along to him, but man, he's picking with his own eyeballs, right? Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, the boastful pride of life. He's got first pick. He picks what he wants. He's a man. He picks what's first and best, okay? Now, 12 and following, watch the difference in just the language here. Watch how God does Abraham. Okay, so 13 is a fascinating verse. I mean, that's a lot of adjectives to describe the people of Sodom. Okay, we know what's coming. And in this day and age, what we know about Sodom and Gomorrah in terms of like Las Vegas is already occurring. Okay, it is sin, it is rampant, and for a number of reasons. And we'll get there as we get to the story in 19. Okay, keep going, Katie. You're doing a great job. Huh. How does Abraham choose? He doesn't. Who chooses? God. Isn't that cool? He gives Lot first dibs, knowing that Lot could have taken the promised land. He could have taken Canaan. He could have taken the area where he is. Lot goes elsewhere. And Abraham's just sitting, and he waits. And God shows up, and he says, man, look around. North, east, south, west, everything that is here. Just like I promised you in chapter 12, I will give it to you. Not just to you, but to who else? Your offspring, which you have exactly zero at this point, none, okay? You got nobody, but I'm going to do what I promised to do, Abraham. I told you, and just because you blew it, by the way, in chapter 13, and walked outside of my will to some degree, I didn't want you to go to Egypt, I'm still going to use you. Sin does not disqualify you. You don't have to be perfect, right? He's repentant, he gets on his face, he walks with God, and God says, I'm still going to use you. The promises that I made to you are still valid.
Do you think there's something to be said that God kind of all at once.
Yeah.
He gets Lot to this land and he says, hey, here you go.
Yep.
I promised you kids.
Yeah.
And I also promised you this land where you're standing.
Yep. Yeah, it's fascinating, kind of the progressive revelation of God and the progressive giving of the promises, if you will. And again, he promises him this stuff. Abraham's never going to see this land. He's going to die with, he owns a cave in the promised land, but that's it. Like, he owns a little field that he bargains for a guy and pays through the nose for, and this little cave to bury himself and Sarah in. That's it. But in terms of this promise, he's having to cling to, okay, God, you're going to do this. So fascinating, because God tends to do that with us as well.
If I'm not mistaken, Abraham is believed to be buried under the Temple Mount, right? No.
He's in Hebron. There's a whole, the cave, it's called the Cave of the Patriarchs. It's in Palestinian-controlled Israel, so in Hebron, and they have a big shrine to it. We can't go there because it's Palestinian-controlled, okay? Yeah, the rest of the patriarchs are brought back there. So, yeah, Abraham, Isaac is there, Jacob is there, Joseph's bones are brought back there by Moses, and I think after that it kind of shuts down. Yeah, but that's it, man. They own like a little cave, so it's fascinating to see what becomes of it. Okay, but God's still working through this guy. And what does he tell him to do in 17? Why? That's how you own it. He's telling Abraham, I will give this to you. This is going to be yours. Walk it. It's yours. So fascinating knowing that backstory. Okay, 18. Katie, finish up for us if you don't mind.
So Abraham moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord.
I mean, we're seeing this theme in his life, this idea of altar, these ideas of rock piles of remembrance, like an Ebenezer is what we see in Samuel. They're just ways to remember God's faithfulness. And as God promises things and he rests and settles, Abraham does in those promises, he builds a rock pile so that when he wakes up and has a bad day in 10 days, he can remember God's faithfulness and what he committed himself to when he's not on some emotional, you know, church high or camp high or Hume high, right? That's all good. But when he comes down the hill and gets back to life and herdsmen are quarreling and Sarah's upset and he can remember that God has been faithful to him and so on and so forth. So we've seen, by the way, at this point, yep, okay, a number of tests, okay? So I would call the first one we talked about, this idea of go, leave your family, he passed. Secondly, in chapter, end of chapter 12, we saw the famine, and we gave him a big fat F, right? Fails, ultimately comes back, God does what he wants to with him. And this third one, I would say, is this idea of land. Will you trust God to provide for you? Okay, and you can label it however you want. But he lets Lot choose first, and God provides for him. So I'd give him a big fat P on that one. Okay, he passes with an A+ in my book. Okay, so as we kind of track that for Abraham, we've seen three of what I would call maybe eight, maybe more, maybe less. You can have as many as you want. But that's kind of how I've labeled them. Okay, and since I wrote the test, you should know how I think about it. Just kidding. Okay. But just think through that, okay? Now, chapter 14, crazy chapter, okay? We are now fast-forwarding a little bit in time. Lot has moved his tents. Chapter 13, verse 12, I just want you to see some of this language. He settles in the cities of the valley and moves his tents as far as Sodom, okay? Just keep that in the back burner and remember that. 14:1 through 6 describes a battle that's taking place. Okay, this is nuts. Yeah, let's go here. Okay. Came about in the days of Amphrael, king of Shinar, Iraq, however you say this guy's name. You see all these kings that are mentioned. Shalmaneser, king of Elam. Okay, we're talking about Shinar, obviously, is in Babylon. Okay, so we're talking about kings from here. Elam is going to be Persia. These guys come in and they attack Canaan, okay? Bizarre. I mean, this is not a short, this is a 400-plus mile journey that these guys, some of them from Susa, in that area, same place where Nehemiah is going to come from when he restores the wall and rebuilds, they come in to attack the land, okay? So, verse 1, you get a list of all the kings that come in. Verse 2, they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, okay? So, Sodom and Gomorrah, with Barsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, all these other places. Bela, you see at the end, is Zoar, which is a town next to Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 3, they came as allies to the Valley of Sodom. And you see these two factions warring, okay? This incoming group of kings that fight against a coalition of kings in the area. So this isn't like a small battle. This is a whole group of kings getting together to fight a common enemy, which are all of those kings. This is a big deal. So lo and behold, we find out the kings that are in the valley get whooped. They get beat by the kings coming from Shinar and Persia and so forth, okay? It's nuts, okay? It really is. In fact, some archaeologists or historians have said there's no way that that can happen. It's too big. It's too grand. It's too many years ago, and it's the real deal, okay? The problem is, where is Lot? He's in that area. He's caught up in kind of the shrapnel, if you will. Verse 11, when these kings that came in from the east win, it says they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. Okay, that's a bad day. Okay, when they whoop you, take your food, take your stuff, you're done. Okay, Vanessa, pick up in verse 12. Watch what else they take. Whoa, so who do they take? Our boy Lot gets caught up in the aftermath. Now, where is he? In Sodom. Where was he at the end of chapter 13? He pitched his tents as far as Sodom. Now he is in Sodom, okay? This is the Death Star, and he's getting sucked in by the tractor beam that is Sodom and Gomorrah, okay? He's progressively moving into the city, and we're going to see what this looks like, okay? So this is a bad deal, right? Not good for Lot. Now, 13, watch what happens. Vanessa, keep rolling if you don't mind. All right, so what happens? He gets word that what's happened?
He let out his trained men.
Yeah, so Lot just got taken. And now what's Abraham do? Sarah, pick up there in 14.
When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he let out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan.
All right, now you guys know the backstory with this. Abraham leads out who?
His trained men.
Why would he have trained men? He's a sheep herder. He's from Sumer. He's trained in these things. He has these available. How many? 318. Abraham's personal army is 318, you know, guys from the movie 300, right? They know how to do battle. They're studs, okay? So he leads these guys out. Now, how do you think Abraham's feeling right now about Lot? Be honest. I gave him first choice, right? He picked the land he wanted. I love you, but man, there's strife. Go live your life. Good for you. I've given you blessings. I've given you stuff. Boy, you're taken care of. And now he's getting sucked into the vortex. And who's the only guy there to save his bacon? Like, really? Abram, okay? Now, this is what's fascinating. It says that he goes as far as where to save him, chapter 14, or verse 14? Dan. Where is Dan? Dan is way the heck up north. This is Dan. So they're here, okay, this is where this battle takes place. Abraham is living, okay, here's Hebron over here. So he journeys north as these kings are leaving town and going back home, catches them, goes as far as Dan, and then we're going to see another city mentioned that you'll be familiar with. Read 15.
He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus.
Whoa, Damascus is in Syria. So Abraham literally is down in Jerusalem in this area and pursues these men as far as Damascus. This is hundreds of miles. It's insane how far he chases him, okay? So to pursue Lot, just to get Lot back, okay? Yeah, think about that. I mean, it's a long, and they don't have a car, right? These guys are hoofing it. This is what's fascinating. It's not just Abraham's guys, okay? We'll get there in a second. But, Jimmy, I want you to hold on to that question, okay, because that's a great observation. All these kings surely have more than 318 dudes if they came in and just spanked everybody. Now, they lost some men in the battle, I'm sure, right? So their troops are probably tired and a little bit worn down and probably less than they brought in. But nonetheless, You wouldn't think a crew of 318 are going to win that battle, okay? And that's a fair argument. So he goes back, verse 16, he brought back all the goods, brought back his relative Lot with his possessions, the women, the people. They took everything when they came in and spanked them, okay? Now, this is kind of a 17 through really 24 and following. It's kind of a crazy theological deal that we're going to get into, so just know that we're going to journey there. This is an odd back and forth that has tremendous implications in our New Testament, okay? So 17, Abraham's won the battle. They returned from the defeating of Shalmaneser, and the kings who were with them, the king of Sodom, went out to meet him. This is Abraham in the valley of Sheva, that is the king's valley. So they're back home. The king of Sodom, who Abraham just rescued from getting spanked by these other kings, comes out to meet Abraham. And there's this other king in verse 18. Somebody pick up there. Okay, this is odd. We haven't seen this, okay? Melchizedek, king of Salem. What does Salem mean, by the way? It means peace, okay? So the king of peace brings out bread and wine. Now, he was a priest of... That's our God. That's the God on our team, okay? He is king and priest of the God Most High, okay? Probably in Jerusalem, okay? First time we've seen this guy. Interesting dude. Yeah, Katie. Food. He's feeding Abraham. That was a good answer. Well done. Yes. So I think they're breaking bread. It's fellowship. It's food. It's celebrating the victory. But what's going to happen here is fascinating, okay? He blessed him and said, Melchizedek blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Who does Melchizedek give credit to for the winning of this battle? God. Our God. Abraham's God and my God. Okay? By the way, what's happening in Canaan with now Abraham being there? What are we seeing? We're seeing other believers, right? We're seeing a king of Jerusalem that is described as both a king and a priest, which is bizarre. You can't do that, by the way. You can't be a king and a priest. I'll show you why in a second. Who worships God. And Abraham wins the battle, and he says, dude, our God gave you that victory. And Abraham's like, amen, he did, okay? End of verse 20. What does Abraham do? He gave him a tenth of all. Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of his spoil of the victory, okay? So Abraham wins the battle. This guy says, man, your God has shown up, our God, and we won the battle. Abraham, what's the biblical word for giving a tenth? What is that called? He ties to Melchizedek a tenth of what he has, okay? Fascinating. Now, verse 21, remember the king of Sodom is watching this conversation go down. He was present for this. He shows up and says, sweet, okay? Watch what he says.
But Abram said to the king of...
21.
And the king
Don't skip 21. It's really good, Katie. Stop skipping verses.
And the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, but keep the goods for yourself.
Okay, so what does king of Sodom ask for? People. Okay, give me the people back, but take the goods for yourself. So anything, I don't want stuff from you. Give me the people back, right, that you've rescued, but, man, take whatever you want. What does Abraham say? 22.
Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, but I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich.
What a fascinating, what? Okay. King of Melchizedek comes in and says, man, you're awesome. Our God won. Abraham gives him stuff in return. The king of Sodom says, dude, I just want my men back. You take whatever you want from the spoil. And Abraham says, I don't want anything of it. Why? What is Abraham's answer as to why he won't take spoils from the king of Sodom, some of his spoils?
Fear he would say, I've made
Abraham rich. A fear that somebody would give credit where credit isn't due. If I take from you, the assumption's going to be that you made me rich instead of God. So I am not going to take anything from you. Yeah.
What God
You see him growing up a little bit? God's going to take care of me. I don't need to take from you. God's blessed me. He's going to continue to bless me. Melchizedek, you're right. Our God won this battle. By the way, the king of Sodom would not have worshipped Abraham's God. So they're chummy, and Abraham just saved his bacon, but he doesn't take anything from him, okay? I will take nothing, verse 24, except, verse 24, what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Jimmy, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their share. Who goes with Abraham into this battle? Who are the men from Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre?
Kings?
Absolutely. Groups of people. Christian or non-Christian? Non. Tell me about Abraham's life in the land. He has set up shop. He worships God. Life hits the fan. He needs to go rescue his brother Lot. Who comes with him? The non-Christians come with him. Why? What has Abraham been doing in the land? He's making friends with non-Christians who love him enough to say, you need someone to go to battle with you? We're in. This isn't come over for dinner, hang out with me, right? This is a fairly large commitment. We're going to go to battle with like six kings that just spanked everybody in this battle to go rescue your nephew who we've never met. Potentially. Maybe they have. But we're going to go rescue a dude, his wife, and their stuff. And they go with him. So this is fascinating to me. So when Abraham needs people to lean on, it's these people that don't worship his God that go with him. Abraham has a witness. He has a testimony. He has a presence in the land. People know who he is. They see his blessing. They like him. He's not a turd. That's fascinating. And these three groups of people, these men from these cities, go with Abraham. So they bring their 150, this guy 700. I don't know how many went. Abraham takes his 318, and these other people join forces who apparently had stayed out of the battle to begin with, and they roll with Abraham. Man, this is how you make a presence in the land. You stand for God, you believe what you believe, but you're not a jerk, right? You're not screaming at non-Christians, telling them they're going to hell. That's not how Abraham's interacting with non-Christians in the land. He's making friends. They like him, and yet they know you disagree with me. You don't worship the Canaanite gods. You worship a different god. But we're still okay. Like, man, boy, that's amazing to me. So he's doing it. So all kinds of implications for you and I's lives. So he's getting it done, okay? So they take them with them, and Abraham says, listen, these guys came with me. All I want is what? You just take care of them. You give them food. You give them. You bless them. That's cool. So he takes care of them. Yeah, Jordan. Yeah.
We see this guy twice.
Twice. That's it. Okay. So let's talk about that. Okay. Family tree. Okay. So you guys have seen this. Okay. So we're going to have Abraham. He's going to have a kid named Isaac. I don't want to ruin the story for you, but he's going to have a kid named Isaac, so he's not going to be barren forever. Isaac's going to have a kid named Jacob, Esau. We're going to see that story. Jacob's going to have Agrippa kids. Okay. The 12 tribes of Israel ultimately come from Jacob. Okay. The priestly line in Israel comes from what kid? That's the kingly line, okay? So if you're going to be a king, you come from Judah, right? The priestly line comes from Levi. So can you be both priest and king? No, because you can't be from Judah and Levi. That's an impossibility. What does Jesus say that he is? Priest and king, right? So if Jesus is going to be priest and king, we know he's from what line? Judah, right? Abraham, we see Judah. David's from Judah. 2 Samuel 7, land, seed, and blessing, that seed portion. God tells David, you're going to have a king on the throne forever from your loin, from Judah through David, now to you, okay? Jesus is from Judah. So how does Jesus have the right to be priest if he's from Judah? He doesn't claim his priesthood through Levi. He claims it through this weird dude, Melchizedek, okay? This is fascinating. Turn to Psalm 110 real quick, okay? This is why this guy becomes so important, but is, like, super mysterious. Psalm 110, The Psalm of David. Here's the next time we see Melchizedek show up in your Bible, okay? We're going to see him here, and then we're going to see him in the book of Hebrews, okay? Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord, okay, Yahweh, says to my Lord, okay, Adonai. Some people believe that to be Jesus. This is more than likely a messianic psalm talking about the Messiah. There's other interpretations to this, what this could mean, but I believe that that's what's going on, okay? So the Lord Yahweh says to my Lord, this is David speaking about the Messiah, okay? The Lord says to my Lord, sit in, at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet, okay? Your enemies are going to be subjected to you one day. Verse 2, the Lord will stretch forth your strong scepter from Zion, the ruling staff of a king, and you will rule in the midst of your enemies. So this Messiah will have a ruling staff, okay? And he will rule from Zion, from Israel, or from Jerusalem, okay? Your people will volunteer freely in the day of your power and holy array from your womb until dawn. Your youth are to you as the dew. So the idea is this is probably even still yet future when Jesus will set up shop in the millennial kingdom on earth and have a literal thousand-year reign on earth as king, and all peoples will submit to him. This has not happened yet, okay? Verse 4, keep going.
The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek.
You, Jesus, Messiah, are a priest forever according to the order of, not Levi, Melchizedek. So he's from Judah, but is claiming his priesthood not from Levi, but from this dude. Okay, odd. Hebrews, go way to your right, okay? Chapter 7, verse 1, we're going to pick up there, okay? See if this doesn't sound familiar. We see Melchizedek, by the way, in Hebrews show up in chapter 5. We see him a little bit in chapter 6.
Is it Hebrews what again?
7, Hebrews chapter 7. And then in Hebrews 7, we get kind of a bit more of the explanation. And this is it. This is all the Melchizedek you get, okay? He's an odd character. For this Melchizedek, 7 verse 1, king of Salem, again, Jerusalem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings whom he blessed, okay? So we're talking about the story that we're in right now in Genesis. To whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth of all the spoils, who was first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, then also king of Salem, which is king of peace, okay? So Abraham met this dude. Abraham tied to him a tenth. We just read that story. And literally, Melchizedek's name means king of righteousness, and king of peace. Write that fifth. You heard it here first, okay? So that's who this dude is we're talking about. 3, Jordan, pick up here. This is fascinating. Okay, wait a second. So you're telling me Melchizedek is without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning nor days nor end of life, okay? Are we talking figurative language here, or are we talking, I think we're talking figurative, okay? The idea is Melchizedek shows up on the scene. We have no idea what his genealogy is. We have no idea where he came from. We have no idea whose father and mother he's from. And this is a picture of Jesus, who literally is without genealogy. Jesus does not have an earthly father who bore him in the same way that you and I got here, right? He was incarnate. He was put in Mary's uterus by God, okay? Without genealogy, without father or mother in that sense. They're comparing Melchizedek as a type of that. So why would that be important that Melchizedek doesn't have a physical genealogy? Why is that important for Jesus' priesthood? Because God appoints the priest through him, right? So he doesn't have to be through a physical line as you would in Levi to be priest. So Jesus says, I have the rightful throne as a king through Judah, and I have the rights to be a priest through Melchizedek. And yet there's no complications there because I don't have to be from two different lines, two different physical lines, okay? So that's where this guy shows up. He's weird, but then again, here you go, okay? So more of Hebrews explains who this guy is in 6 and following, or 4 and following of chapter 7, but that's the idea. And the argument in Hebrews is his priesthood, Melchizedek's priesthood, is better than Aaron and Moses and Levi's priesthood because it's permanent, it's without sin. There's not this need for perpetual sacrifice. So Hebrews is your New Testament Leviticus, by the way. Okay. So until you understand Leviticus, you're not going to understand Hebrews. The book of Hebrews was written to Hebrews, Jews, and the argument from the author, who we don't know who wrote Hebrews, is saying this system is better than going back to your old system of continual sacrifice, this yearly deal where you have to sacrifice goats and lambs forever. We have a high priest who did that once for all forever. His name is Jesus. Trust in him. Don't go back to an old system. Okay? That, by the way, for those of you guys that have read Hebrews chapter 6, makes Hebrews chapter 6 perfectly understandable, okay? So that's a whole other story for a different day, and we'll get into that, okay? Shay will cover it. But that's the idea. This is Leviticus for Jewish believers, okay? So that's the importance, okay? So as you see Melchizedek, that's why he shows up in Scripture. Jesus is going to trace his line to be the priest through Melchizedek, not Levi. Correct. Correct. Yep. Yep.
Cool.
So there you go. So that's why Jesus has the right to be priest and king. Okay. That is a role, by the way, in Scripture that is always separated. You've got a priestly line and you've got a kingly line. Why, by the way, are those separate? Yeah, you can't do both, right? That's too much power. That's too much stuff. Yeah. You don't want any one individual with a sin nature like you and me to have that kind of power. Okay, I don't want that job. Okay, that's way too much control. And that's why Jesus, or why God separates them to some degree.
Sorry, I don't understand the rule. Like a king and a priest, what's their reason?
Yeah, so that priestly role is going to get defined in Leviticus. They are the ones that make the offering on behalf of God or behalf of man to God. They're the go-between, okay? They're going to take a sinful humanity and a holy God, and connect them. They're going to be the means by which God says, okay, I'm going to be able to commune with you sinners because of the sacrifice offered on behalf of the people given by the hands of the priest. So they're the mediator. They're the exact same thing that the Catholic Church thinks that priests are today. You don't have a direct relationship with God in that sense. You need someone to step in on your behalf so that you can have a relationship with God. That system is done and gone because of Jesus. But in this day and age, that's how they interacted with God. Unless there was a blood sacrifice, you've got a sinful people and a holy God, and that doesn't work.
And then to communicate with God or to commune with God and then also to rule over the people.
That was the king's job.
The king. Okay.
Yep. Order, obey laws, make decisions.
So that's why Jesus is in context. I mean, obviously he's powerful, but that's why in context he's so powerful, because he is the mediator between us and God. And he rules.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's the, yeah, both pictures. Okay. Yeah, Kyle.
Does Hebrews at all go into detail behind, I don't know Hebrews enough, but how Melchizedek acquired that priesthood from God? Did it just kind of like pops out of nowhere and then being like, hey, Abram, great job, man? And then it's just like, oh, cool.
That's why he's this anomaly. Yeah. It's kind of like that. So we don't get a whole lot more than that. Yeah.
And then as he goes in, like you read Hebrews 9, and it talks about it being taught, like he's building his army for the supremacy of Christ over the priesthood as supreme priest. But then even in Genesis 15, Genesis 14, and we get into the covenant anyway.
Yeah. Just think about that, how the New Testament authors thought about the Old Testament. This is Genesis 14, this crazy story that they see is absolutely happened, absolutely real, absolutely valid in every stretch of the imagination, as well as the Psalms that David wrote, right? It's just, it's a great view, right? Jesus, as he wrote, validates Moses in his writing of everything that we're reading, like five different times in the text. Talks about Moses authoring Genesis and Leviticus and beyond, right? The Torah. So anyway, fascinating, but cool picture nonetheless, all right? So back to Genesis 14. Let's finish up this crazy kooky dude, Melchizedek. So beautiful. So as we look at maybe what I would say is another a test of Abraham, what was the temptation here? Okay. Why would Abraham have been torn with this decision of do I take from King of Salem? I'm sorry, King of Sodom, not Salem. What's that? Absolutely. It's exactly what it is. Okay. How does Abraham do?
Good.
And he passes. So fantastic. Okay. So he passes that test. So he had the opportunity, label it however you want. I call it sell out. Are you going to sell out so that you can get more stuff, more possessions, more money, second house in Vail? Or are you going to trust God that God will provide and give you what you need and give credit to him and him alone? And Abraham says, I'm going to go with God on this one. Okay. So cool. All right. So end of that story. Now, chapter 15, 10 years later, okay, we met Abraham in chapter 12, chapter 11, really. He was 75 years old. According to chapter 16, verse 3, it's 10 years later. These stories fit together. We've got a 10-year gap. Abraham is 85 years old, and watch what happens, 15, verse 1. All right, so after these things, meaning probably pretty soon after this battle just occurred, God now shows up again to Abraham. So he's been in land for 10 years. That's why he's developed these relationships. So we're seeing some time go by. And God comes to him and says, don't fear. I am a shield to you. Fascinating language. Why would God say this to Abraham now? What just occurred in his life? Bro, you just went through a huge war. There's real danger. You could have lost your life. What does God say to Abraham? Don't fear. Why? I'm your protection. I am your, the Psalms talks about, hiding place, rock. I will protect you. You need not fear. These promises that I gave you are real. I'm going to take care of you. Okay. Now, this is fascinating too. Listen to what Abraham's thinking about. I love this. So, what's on Abraham's brain 10 years later? Yeah. God says, I'll protect you. Abraham says, I'm not worried about protection. Where's my heir? Where is the fulfillment of this promise you gave me 10 years ago? What's Abraham thinking about? He's thinking about what God thinks about. This is what God cares about. God wants to give him these things, and Abraham's like, I'm on board. Yes. Like, protection is not my biggest concern here. Thank you. Yes, you are indeed my shield. Where's my heir? How am I going to live out what you promised in me? I don't have a kid. So will Eleazar from Damascus be my heir? Again, culturally, I don't have a son. My most trusted servant in my household is now going to become my adopted son. Is Eleazar from Damascus the guy? Is that what you meant by the kid that I'm going to have? And God says, no, 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 no. Verse 3. So Abraham says, this must be it. Keep going.
And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord and he counted it to him as righteousness.
A lot here, okay. So God says, no, it's not Eleazar. You are going to have a kid born to you from your own body, okay. You and Sarah are going to do what husband and wife do. You are going to have a child from your own body, not your adopted son, Eleazar, not your adopted servant, okay? And in him so shall your descendants be. Verse 6, he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. This, by the way, is the theme verse of the book of Romans. Paul is going to use this argument when he's arguing about faith and faith alone to the Jews to say, this is how you're saved. By the way, fast forward a little bit. Abraham is in a period prior to Moses. So does Abraham even have the law to obey? No, he doesn't have a law. How does God see him? As righteous, as standing in right position before him. Has Abraham been circumcised like every good Jew post-Moses will do? No, there is no circumcision. We don't even know about that yet, okay? That's not happening. So apart from the law, apart from circumcision, this is the argument that Paul is going to make to the Jews. The father of your faith, Abraham, was viewed as righteous before God. He's done nothing. He believed God, and that belief was credited into his account as righteousness. That's fascinating, okay? This is what the book of Romans is going to be built on. So when you guys get there with Shay in the spring, remember that. This is fascinating. We don't have time necessarily to get into it now. But you kind of see the idea of God's promise that came in 12. We see it repeated a little bit in 13 of, man, Abraham, I'm still with you. I'm going to do these things. Abraham in 15 is thinking about these things. And there's this sense, whether it's right here in this moment or it's a culmination or it's happened before, that Abraham goes, I got it. I truly believe in what you've said. Even though I don't have a kid, even though these things haven't appeared in my life, God, I fully trust you. I believe your word. And in that moment, God says, I've credited that to your account as righteousness. You are in right standing before me. So fascinating. Again, circumcision's not going to come until chapter 17. And the law's not going to come until Exodus and beyond, long after Abraham's dead. Okay, so fascinating that God has this relationship with Father Abraham prior to all these things. So, cool.
Verses 4 through 6, that this whole section that Romans is really...
Really 6 is the, yeah, I mean, that's the argument. But that one verse in 15:6 is the one where Paul is going to use as a launching point to his argument to the Jews that it's not about the law, it's not about circumcision, it's not about anything but faith, and faith alone, belief in what Jesus did. Okay, you don't need to get baptized, you don't need to obey the law, you don't need to do anything.
And I think it was Dr. Allen, he shared with us that there is an aspect here of he had faith and God set him up for stuff, but there was a part of this where he goes, maybe it's not him, but we have a responsibility. He didn't go, hey, like we're just magically going
right.
to have a child. Like he
right.
went out and made love to his wife and produced a child
yeah.
kind of thing. So
yeah.
there's a sense of
certainly.
Human obedience
yep.
to this whole aspect.
Absolutely. It's not a blind faith. There's certainly responsibility on our side. We have the responsibility to believe the gospel, right? So, yeah, there's that dual tension where it's all God, but yet we have responsibility. We're held accountable for how we choose or don't choose. Though the choice is God. So, yep, you're going to see that tension all throughout here, but that's right on. Okay? What I love about Abraham 10 years later is he cares about what? Not money, not stuff, not a second house. Lord, what do you care about? This is what I want to care about. And that's the growing up that we're seeing of this guy, right? Different guy than we saw 9, 7, whatever years ago that ran to Egypt in a famine and went, oh, we're all going to die, you know? He's like, no, Lord, I trust you. So we're seeing him kind of settle into his faith bit by bit, okay? Verse 7, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur, the Chaldeans, to give you this land to possess it. Verse 8, he said, O Lord, how may I know that I shall possess it? And he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, a partridge in a pear tree, and a young pigeon. Okay, bring me all this stuff. Okay, he brought all these to God. This is really cool, by the way. And he cut them in two. He laid each half opposite each other, but he did not cut the birds. Okay, so he says, Abraham, bring me all this stuff. How am I going to know? And God says, all right, we're going to spit and shake on this. Here's how it's going to work. We're going to formalize this agreement. You're going to cut all these animals in two, and you're going to separate them, okay? Half the animal on this side, half the animal on that side, and we're going to create like a conga line, okay? Now, watch what happens. When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Okay, so this is an odd situation. Now, watch what God does here to like, stamp with authority his word and what's going to happen. Thomas, pick up there in 13.
And then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there. And they will be afflicted for 400 years.
Okay, hold on. What is God talking about? Egypt. By the way, Abraham, let me just really quickly predict like 1,000 years into the future, real quick for you. Your people, who you don't even have a kid yet, your people are going to go to a foreign land. They're going to be slaves in that land for 400 years, okay? 440 to be exact. But God says, just so you know that I'm in control of all things, I'm going to predict something that's still 400 We're in like 2000. We're like 500-600 years away from this event. But I'm going to go ahead and call my shot now, just so you know how big I am. Okay, keep going.
But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possession.
But I'm not going to forget them. I'm going to bring them out. Okay, that's in 1446 when the Exodus occurs. We're in 2100 right now.
As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.
Meaning I'm still using the pagan peoples of the land to kind of spank y'all a little bit. So I'm putting these pagan people to use to discipline you guys. So just so you can kind of get a glimpse, Abraham, of my grand plan, here's what's going on behind the scenes. I'm, by the way, really big. Okay, so he tells this to Abraham. Okay. As he puts in verse 12, a deep sleep upon him, okay? So he's dreaming this, being told this, I don't know, okay? Verse 17, this is super cool.
When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces.
Okay, what? So God sends like an oven and a smoking fire pot through these pieces of cut up animals. And then says in 18,
on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Cadmonites, the Hittites, Perizzites, and the Rephaim, the Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites.
Dude, well done. You got a lot of ites in there. Well done. What the heck is going on here? What is God doing? Okay, that's an option. Are there any other ideas? So God cuts these animals in two and then sends an oven and a flaming pot through. What is that? And then says, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. What's Abraham doing right now? He's sleeping. And there's this oven and flaming. The picture is, in that day and age, when you made an agreement, you would cut an animal in half, and the two of you would make an agreement, and then you would walk through it together as if to say, if either one of us break this agreement, may this happen to us. May death occur if we drop our end of the deal. What's Abraham doing? Sleeping. Does Abraham walk through? No. Why? It has nothing to do with him. I will. Five times, Genesis 12. I am going to do these things. Abraham, let me predict the future. You go night-night. And the best picture that God could give of himself, terror, fear, holiness, heat, flame, walks through this cut parts as if to say, it's done. This is going to happen. And in a very good way, there's terror and fear, fear in the sense of an awe of God. The holiness of God is walking through these parts in some way, shape, or form, okay? And Abraham realizes, this isn't up to me. God is going to fulfill this because this is his covenant with me. By the way, in verse 18, the Lord made a covenant. The literal word in Scripture is cut a covenant. Okay, you don't make a covenant, you cut a covenant, as in cutting two animals apart, okay? So again, Mike's soapbox, this is the wedding language. This is the language that we use of a man and a woman becoming one flesh and a covenant together that they will commit to their vows regardless, come literally hell or high water, they're sticking it out, okay? So for those of you guys that are single, remember that. It is a big deal in the eyes of God to stand before him and to make a covenant about how you're going to live life and how you're going to commit to your spouse, okay? I assure you there are days that Michelle wakes up and looks at me and goes, I don't even like you today. Like, you're a turd. But I'm going to love you despite who you are because of the covenant that I made to you, and hopefully you'll come around out of your knothead status and apologize or whatever Mike needs to do that day. But that's the idea. Love is a choice. Love is not a feeling. This covenant of God is a promise, regardless of anything else that happens, of what he will do, okay? So we get a really cool picture of that in us. So, amazing, okay? Yeah.
Why didn't he cut the birds in half?
I don't know. No, I'm not sure. Verse 13, we skipped it. The birds of prey came down to the carcasses, and Abraham drove them away. So it's almost as if he's keeping the birds from interfering with this process? I don't know. Yeah, there's some. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and pigeons are game on in Leviticus for sacrifice. We're going to see those for that is the substitute for a poor person to offer in lieu of maybe a more expensive animal. They could offer a pigeon. I don't know.
Is there a reference or meaning for all the different animals in the sacrifice? Like, what are all these different things and what do they represent?
I don't know. Obviously, some of the idea of heifer and goats are going to be a part of the Levitical system. So these are all things that are going to show up later in Leviticus. Some are for sin, some are for atonement, some are for different things. So we'll see pictures of those. I don't know that they mean that much here other than we're seeing the idea of blood sacrifice again, the covenant which is enveloped in blood. So we're seeing blood spilt by another to affirm that this is a big deal. I think the bigger picture behind it is that. Death of another on behalf of you, blood, covenants are always revolving around kind of that picture of and the seriousness of it. And by the way, what do you see at the end of 18 for the very first time? We see the land, but now we see like boundaries. We see literally from the great Egypt as far as the great river, from Egypt as far as the great river, which could be the Nile. It could be, did I put that in here? Maybe? Come on, Mike. Yep, okay. So this is that teal area, is probably, as best we know, kind of a portion of the land that God had given to them, maybe further east, but we talk about the Great River. This isn't the Nile, by the way. It could be another border, but the Sinai Peninsula down here into the wilderness, okay? So we see Beersheba is, by the way, here, Abraham's kind of home base, and all the way up here to the western reaches of the Euphrates River are here. So this is probably the land that God had intended for him. Okay, so by the way, here's the Sea of Galilee. Okay, this is the northern border of the land. Here's Hazor, that is the top edge. We see in here Damascus, which is in present-day Syria, as part of the Promised Land. Lebanon is up here, modern-day Lebanon, with Sidon and Beirut. Okay, Beirut's at least a familiar city today. This is all part of God's promised land to them, okay? Israel, by the way, has never occupied all this. This land, this promise, has still not been fulfilled as of 2016. So something's going to occur with this in the millennial kingdom. It needs to be fulfilled in some way, shape, or form, unless the people of God are now the church and is really Israel and we fulfilled it spiritually. I don't think that. So I think there's still something yet future with this. So, okay? So just to give you an idea, that's the scope of the land, okay? The pink part in there, or purple, sorry, I'm colorblind, and my box of crayons is 8. I don't have all these fancy words for colors. Is land that Ephraim and Manasseh, two of the tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel, are going to be given as they come in. And half of the tribe of Gad, we'll get there, will be given that as they come into the promised land. And we'll see why that's the case as we get into the book of Joshua. So that's coming. Or Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy. Okay? So that's coming. So that's where we're at in the grand scheme of things. Okay? So, cool picture of what God's doing, his holiness, and so on and so forth, okay? 16, let's see how Abraham does, okay? He's just been promised all this by God. This is kind of a mountaintop experience, if you will. He's on a spiritual high. God's promised he's going to take care of him. He's seen this really cool thing, probably revealed to Abraham in a dream of God's going to take care of you. 16:1. Okay, and where did Hagar come from? Egypt. Okay, so Abraham picked her up in his journey in chapter 13, coming out of Egypt. Okay, so here's Sarah's advice, verse 2.
And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant it may be according to your word, that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai.
All right, so which this makes some sense, right? In this day and age, there is no in vitro. You've got a handmaid. God said, it's going to come from your own loins, your loins, Abraham, maybe not mine, because I'm barren. So you should go into my handmaid, make a child with her. We'll raise that child as our own. That's how God is going to appoint a child for us. So culturally, this makes perfect sense. What's the problem with that? Yeah, she's not Sarah. Emily? They don't, but the assumption is that it was it was Sarah, not Abraham, for whatever reason. So whether that was known that it was like she's barren or they just can't have kids, what they know is they can't have kids. The text seems to allude that obviously it's Sarah, which we know it is. But yeah. Well, it's going to come through them, so they're promising both of them. But like, yeah, well, we know that to be true based on what we're going to see, because God's going to say, no, 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 this is not what I meant. Yeah, true, from your loins. So yeah, medically, yeah, it could be either side. We obviously know this in hindsight to be on Sarah's side. And again, we're going to see this picture of the womb that God is in full control of all through the Old Testament. It's fascinating. So what does Abraham do?
He listens to the voice of Sarah.
Yeah.
Not to like ruin the story or anything, but we know that Hagar's son Ishmael is later that creates a line that is in direct dispute with Israel.
Correct.
Is that reflective of Genesis 1? No, it's where God says that, like, if you do not do well, sin is crashing at the door and it will rule over you. Is that reflective of that verse, how ultimately, like, Abram forgot, he took his eyes off of what God had promised, he sinned, and ultimately it's going to come back to bite him?
To some degree, yeah, maybe. I think more directly, in what Thomas is alluding to, obviously Ishmael is the kid that's going to come from this. So they're going to have a baby. Kid's going to be named Ishmael. This is the physical line of the Palestinians and the Arabs that are going to come from Ishmael and his kin. They are going to get both a blessing and a curse from God. Okay, so the tension that we still feel 4,000 years later between these two people groups, between Jews, Hebrews, and Arabs and Palestinians, is ancient. It's 4,000 plus years old. So that's, I think, specifically where that comes from. But yeah, I think to some degree, Abraham takes his eyes off God for a moment, doesn't walk in the trust that he had in chapter 15, and listens to Sarah and says, man, that makes sense. Let's do it. You know, he's about the right things, but man, he's kicking doors in as opposed to letting God open them in his due time.
Wasn't Hagar and Sarah, like, they didn't like each other?
I think at this point they're okay. When Hagar has a kid, that's when it's going to get ugly. Bitterness, jealousy, frustration is going to set in because Sarah's been trying to have a kid now for 10 years, and Hagar's going to, okay, here's a kid. And that's what's going to create the tension. So we're going to see that unfold right now. Okay? So does that make sense? So what should have Abraham have done? Verse 2. Yeah, not, right? So guys, the life lesson in this is don't listen to your wife, okay? It says in verse 2 that, oh wait, kidding, okay? Abraham's going to get in trouble for listening to his wife here. He's going to get blessed later for listening to his wife, okay? So Sarah's got great ideas. She's thinking about the same thing. Her heart is in the same place as Abraham's. They're just rushing the process a little bit, okay? Abraham, like Adam, probably should have stepped in and said, okay, hold on, time out. Let's talk to God. Lord, is this how you want us to do it or not, okay? It's one of those things that is completely culturally acceptable, but to God it's not. That's not how God wanted to fulfill it. And I think had Abraham stopped here and said, Lord, okay, it's not Eleazar. You said from my own loins, do you want me to do this? Do you want me to do this process? It's okay. And God says, no, that's not what I meant. It's not that this is sin per se, though you could maybe argue that it is, but this is not how God wanted this to go down. And they move too fast and don't stop. There's no consultation with God. Abraham listened to the voice of his wife. And after Abraham was in the land of Canaan 10 years, Abraham took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maid, husband, as her husband, and went into her. So verse 4, she conceived. I mean, there's no God. There's no prayer. There's no stopping to figure out, Lord, is this what you want? So, okay, so that's... That's it. So how is he doing in this idea of waiting in patient trust an heir here of God? I give him a fail, right? Now, this is the same Abraham who we're seeing make significant strides spiritually in trust, and we're seeing his faith grow. Does that mean that he's not going to screw up anymore? Does that mean that just because you're a mature Christian that you're not going to blow it and make poor decisions? No. Like, this is a, he shouldn't have done this, but he blows it. And we're going to see, as a godly man, he's going to respond as well. But be encouraged, okay? Godly, mature people make dumb decisions, okay? I being a prime example of that often, okay? So God's gracious with him, and you and I are going to struggle with that as well. So he walks outside of what I think God would have wanted, doesn't stop, doesn't pray, and he's going to feel the consequences of that. So goes into her, verse 4, they have a kid, and when she saw, Sarah, that she had conceived Hagar, her mistress was despised in her sight. That is bitterness, jealousy, envy. She's with kid. Why is God blessing her? But working. I mean, you can feel the frustration in Sarah, right? You can feel her pain. Okay, for talking to women that are barren today that can't have kids, this is incredibly painful to watch people around you knock out kids like they're going out of style, and you can't have children. It is so hard to work through. Correct. Yeah. I don't know. Despised in her sight is what NASB says.
Mm-hmm.
Read that for us real quick and let's talk about it.
And Sarai said to Abram, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me.
Yeah, mine says, I was despised in her sight. So, yeah, there could have been this, I'm the new queen bee. I got a kid. What do you got, Sarah? Nothing. So it's both ways. There's definitely a bitterness on both sides. So Hagar's not innocent in that, and Sarah's not innocent in her response either. So there's a tension, and a right tension. So this is hard. So 2 verses ago, Sarah says, this is a great idea. And 2 verses later, she's like, this is your fault, and may the wrong done to me be on you, Abraham. Abraham's like, I did exactly what you wanted me to do. Like, what have I done? And now you're mad at me, right? This never, ever happens in marriage, ever, right? So I live with 4 women, and there's times I'm like, I'm going to go back in my office, and you guys let me know when this is sorted. I'm going to go hang out with a male dog, and we're going to do male things, and just you do your female stuff. So anyway, so I understand the ups and downs, right? This is seriously a difficult, difficult situation, okay? Can you do the wrong thing with the right intentions? Absolutely. Can you do the right thing at the wrong time? Yeah.
It's kind of like the you know, how I told you we started the after-school program in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
One of the kids stole a bunch of backpacks to give them to his friends that couldn't afford backpacks. And it was like wrong thing, but it was like right intentions.
Yeah.
I was just like, no, bro, that's not how you do it.
It's a great example, right? Love your heart. There's probably a better way to get there, right? So, but that's it. Man, their heart's in the right spot, but they're just rushing the process. By the way, we're still 15 years away from a kid. They're only 10 years into this. They got 15 more years to wait. That's insane. Why is God doing this? Yeah, God's not in a hurry. It's like wine. He's going to put it in the bottle. He's going to turn it. It's going to get better with time, right? He's going to work it, and he's making sure this process marinates, and he's making dang sure when Sarah has a kid at 90 years old and Abraham is 100, that there's no question that this is impossible. And God says, yep, that's where I like to work. I like to work in the impossible. We're not impossible yet, Abraham. You're only 85. She's only 75. Not yet. Yeah.
You're like 400 years of oppression.
Yeah.
Like that's not going to be one generation.
Yeah.
It's going to be generations.
Yeah. Well, and just the idea that you're going to have that many, you're going to have a whole group of people that are going to go. Like, from you, you can't even number the, I think he's more excited about the idea that that's what's going to occur. I'm going to have so many kids, you can't even number them. How is that possible? So I think he's excited about that. Remember that too, guys, by the way, and we'll finish here. Your greatest moments of struggle are very rarely at the bottom. They're at the top. It's in those moments where you're on a spiritual high, you're untouchable, all's good. That's sometimes when you're the most vulnerable. Abraham is at the bottom, man, in a war, and man, he is clinging to God. Trust him in the midst of that. It's on this time when God has just shown him like 400 plus years or 600 plus years into the future that he's like, you know, then he blows up. So just keep that in mind, all right? So we'll pick it there tomorrow. You guys have a great day. We're a bit over.